The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, so we are going to begin the presentation of this panel, Human Rights in Crisis Situations. We are delighted to have a very distinguished panel that's bringing a very interesting vision about what's happening in several regions of the world with human rights in context of very complex situations. I think the panelists here will bring a very interesting perspective on the complexities that surround the analysis of human rights in situations where not necessarily human rights are the only concern. I would like, first of all, and finally after I will make a presentation of the panel, just to leave you with a phrase, The Economist, precisely the last economist when analyzing the situation in Colombia, had a very interesting statement, which I think it's quite provocative, and it will help us, you know, give us some food for thought. The Economist in this article basically stated as a minor conclusion that it is naive to think that human rights can be protected and the countryside developed in an atmosphere of violence. I would simply leave that analysis. Of course, I'm taking it out of context, and that's quite unfair, but I think that will give us some interesting basis to initiate the discussion. First of all, I would like to present Mark Schneider. We are delighted to have him here. Thank you very much, Mark, for being in this panel. And let me just tell you, Mark Schneider is Senior Vice President and Special Advisor on Latin America. He directs the Washington Advocacy Office, conveying crisis group analysis and recommendations to the White House, the State Department, and the Department of Defense, Congress, as well as the World Bank and other international organizations. He also serves as Special Advisor on Latin America and on HIV/AIDS and security. Mr. Schneider has been also Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights from 1977 to 1979. I'll leave you then with Mark.
Okay. Should be from here or there.
Whatever you want, you can.
Okay. Well, I think I'll just speak from here. First, let me just say that I appreciate the opportunity to participate in this 25th anniversary celebration of the International Legal Studies Program, the Washington College of Law. And I have to admit that I feel some pride in the accomplishments of the program, because I was one of those who argued some 25 years ago that bringing Claudio Grossman to American University would be a wise thing for this university to do. I think also, since I noted the Netherlands background, first time I met Claudio, he was living in the Netherlands after fleeing the Pinochet dictatorship. And I was heading the United States delegation to the Human Rights Commission at the time. And Claudio was in the corridor demanding that the commission take action against the Pinochet regime for violations of human rights, for torture, disappearances. And I think that we all can be proud that he's maintained that commitment to human rights around the world ever since. And I should say that, obviously, that I have some bias since I received an honorary degree from the Washington College of Law and now serve on the American University Board of Trustees. So I do appreciate the work that's being done here and the fact that this program is now about fifth in the nation, I think, in terms of U.S. News and World Report ranking for international law programs. So you all should be very proud of that. Now, for the past several years, I've worked with the International Crisis Group. I'm the Senior Vice President for the group, which is based in Brussels, but I run the Washington office. And essentially, we're dedicated to prevent conflict, and where conflict exists, to try and bring it to an end. And in the aftermath of bringing it to an end, to try and help countries and institutions develop post-conflict programs that result in sustaining peace, as opposed to their failure, which inevitably results in the recurrence of war and usually a recurrence of human rights violations. Now, our moderator asked me to reflect a little bit for some reason on the relationship between human rights abuse and conflict in Colombia. Before doing that, Let me just note that the International Crisis Group now operates in about 62 countries. We have about 23 field offices. And what we do, and we left some of the reports upstairs, we attempt to do independent, objective analysis of the drivers of conflict from the field base. Our people are on the ground talking with everybody, and they have a tremendous degree of both access, intelligence, knowledge of the society, and courage. It's a lot easier being in Washington and trying to convince the administration to adopt their recommendations than to be in the field trying to define what needs to be done. We began, by the way, after Rwanda and after Sarajevo because of the belief that in the post-Cold War era, simply the major powers were not concerned about conflicts taking place in some of these countries because there was no longer a strategic link. After 9/11, that clearly is not the case. There is a strategic link for every country. Now, in looking at the issue as it relates to human rights, first let me just mention one thing, which is that from the beginning, we have looked at the relationship between human rights and conflict at the global level. The president of the crisis group, Gareth Evans, was one of those who defined the concept of responsibility to protect, which really was another step in the evolution, I would say, of international human rights and national sovereignty, and the view that at some point the international community, it doesn't have the right to intervene, but has the responsibility to protect. And last year, after the Millennium Plus Five summit, that concept actually was adopted, that the individual nation states have a responsibility to act to prevent mass atrocities and war crimes and ethnic cleansing, but when they fail to do that or are complicit in those violations, then the international community has an obligation to move to act. And while the concept was adopted, it clearly has yet to be embedded in the practice either of the institutions or of other nations. And that's one of the things that we're doing as an organization, is attempting to spread an acceptance and awareness of the concept and a recognition that there are certain times, as in Darfur, when there needs to be a response. And there has yet to been an adequate response in the case of Darfur. So let me now turn to Colombia. Colombia is in the fourth decade of a civil war. I say civil war because something that in Colombia they really don't like to hear. But that's in fact, it's a civil conflict that continues to produce serious violations of human rights and of international humanitarian law that are both consequences of the conflict and in many ways drivers of the conflict. And let's be clear that those responsible for the violations are at all sides of the conflict, whether the FARC or the ELN, which are the left-wing guerrilla groups involved, which have been carrying out attacks on state institutions for some 40 years, or the paramilitary militias. And now I've defined, as you know, the paramilitary have been going through a demobilization process, but there's a significant number of groups have either not fully demobilized or reformed. And so the responsibility of the state to deal with, let's call them reparas, and the relationship with government security forces has not yet been resolved. For the past 5 years, we've been issuing reports on the conflict, what fuels it, and why the government of Alvaro Uribe, despite his clear political success, has been unable to halt the conflict or to end continued violations of human rights by government security forces as well as by the guerrilla forces and the paramilitary. I think it's important to emphasize that at least for most of his first term, President Uribe denied that there were linkages between the military forces, security forces of his country, police forces, intelligence arm of the country, and the paramilitary. Over the past several months, what might refer to as the dark corners of Colombia's security and criminal outcroppings have been exposed by what they call the Para Politica scandal. And the result of that, the investigations by the country's Attorney General and Supreme Court have disclosed that in 2002 and subsequently there were direct connection and financing between the paramilitary organizations and many politicians, particularly in the party that supported President Uribe. A half a dozen congressmen have been indicted, 20 are under investigation, one governor has resigned, another one is also under suspicion, foreign ministers resigned, and her father, brother, and cousin are under suspicion. And the 50 paramilitary leaders, who, by the way, are residing in the high-security prison in Itagüí, are threatening to fully expose all relationships with current and past government and military officials. So that is, I think, at this point, there's no longer a question about whether or not the linkages exist. The only question is to what extent and what will be done about them. Nevertheless, I should add that the United States government still proposes to keep unaltered Plan Colombia with an 80-20 split between military and civilian aids, and it still opposes human rights conditionality on that assistance. That's been imposed by act of the Congress now for the past several years. I rarely make predictions, but I predict that the human rights conditionality will not only continue, but be more stringent after the FY 2008 Foreign Operations Appropriation Bill is passed by the House and Senate this year. And my guess is that it will not only contain much more stringent conditions with respect to the relationship between the government and the paramilitary organizations, but I also suspect that there may well be, by law, a requirement for a different allocation between the aid provided to Colombia, much more along the lines of 50-50. Now, without any question, over the last several years, one of the reasons why President Uribe has been successful politically is because the counterinsurgency part of the combined counterinsurgency, counter-drug policy has been successful in reducing the level of threat in Bogota and in the major cities from the FARC. And as a result, I think that there's a sense that this is successful. That's why, despite everything, he still has wide popularity personally of some 70-plus percent approval ratings. Nevertheless, the human rights violations have continued, and I think it's important to talk about what I've described as four overlapping human rights crises today in Colombia. First, there's the violence of all of the illegal armed groups that violates international humanitarian law. Last year, the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights reported that the guerrillas, particularly those of the FARC EP, and to a lesser extent the ELN, continued to commit homicides, massacres, acts of terrorism, threats and attacks on the civilian population, hostage taking, use of anti-personnel mines, recruitment of boys and girls, and attacks on the medical mission. In virtually identical terms, the report stated the paramilitaries repeatedly violated their commitment to a cessation of hostilities and persisted in committing homicides, threats and attacks against the civilian population, hostage taking, torture and humiliating, degrading treatment, forced displacements, and recruitment of boys and girls. This year, the Spanish language version of the report just came out, and it again identifies those violations. The second crisis involves the commitment of human rights violations by security forces of the government, and particularly by elements of security police known as the DAS. It's the Spanish acronym for Administrative Security Department. It's sort of like a combination of the FBI and the CIA directed at Colombians. And in disproportionate numbers, the victims have been indigenous and Afro-Colombians. A year ago, the report of the High Commissioner noted those violations and at the same time cited the existence of a pattern of extra extrajudicial executions and forced disappearances carried out by the security forces. And this year, again, it refers to the fact, which is important, that these are carried out by the acquiescence of authorities. And it states that that these violations are not simply carried out by one military unit, but they involve a significant number of different military units. At the same time, this violence has been directed at specific groups: human rights activists, labor leaders. This year, in fact, the UN Human Rights Report says there's been an increase in murders of labor leaders and teachers, and again against members of the press. The violations of human rights reflect the conflict, and to some degree, they go back to the point of the rejection of full participation in the political process. That was a major cause of the conflict, let's say, 40 years ago. But to some degree, that cause is no longer valid, because there are, as you know, in Colombia, the former members of the guerrillas of M19 are now members of the Congress. There's a member of the former guerrilla just ran for the presidency. So that no longer is a rationale. The problem now in Colombia is that there's a mix between the political rationale, the linkage between all of these groups and drug trafficking, less the ELN, and the refusal of the government, in a sense, to alter its own relationship with elements of the security forces which engage in violations of human rights. Now, the third factor in this, in the third crisis, if you will, is the issue of impunity. Simply that in Colombia, impunity for the commission of these human rights violations continues. And it's the failure of a relatively strong, if one looks at other countries in conflict, institutional structure to deal with the problem of impunity that has permitted both the conflict and the human rights abuses to continue. Over the course of the past year, for the first time, in relation to the implementation of the Justice and Peace Law, not the government, that is not the executive branch, but the Fiscal General, the Attorney General's office, which is independent, and the Supreme Court, have demonstrated their institutional strength in bringing these abuses and linkages between the paramilitary and the armed forces to the fore. It's their actions, which initially were condemned by the executive branch, that really are beginning, perhaps, to make inroads against impunity in Colombia. And finally, there's a humanitarian crisis in which there are still 5,400 kidnapped victims in the hands of the captors. Most FARC, there are 2,500 unaccounted for. There are 2.9 million internally displaced in Colombia over the past decade. And the Supreme Court has ruled time and again, the Constitutional Court, that the government has failed in its responsibilities to provide relief to the displaced. So where are we? What does this tell us about conflict and human rights violations together? Some elements are uniquely Colombian, some are not. First, as you look at the conflict, the existence of paramilitary and militias, not under the control of official military but linked to them, is a virtual guarantor of human rights abuse. Colombia, Darfur, West Africa, Congo, Afghanistan, Iraq, any time that you provide resources, money, and weapons to organizations which are not fully under the control and transparently under the control of authorities, the likely end result is violations of human rights.
where the rule of law is unable to hold accountable the armed forces or other human rights abusers, the violators believe they can escape penalties and will continue their action. And here in Colombia, as elsewhere, ethnic and racial discrimination and inequality place indigenous and Afro-Colombian minorities disproportionately among the victims of armed conflict. And in Colombia, as in almost every other conflict, women and children are among the most vulnerable. Now, right now, if you're thinking about acting to do something about the situation, let me give you three issues. The first is the extension of the UN High Commission for Human Rights mandate in Colombia. Last year, the government of Colombia unhappily agreed to a single year's extension and attempted to reduce its mandate. I think it's very important for everyone to begin now to work to extend the mandate of that office, which ends in September, not merely for a year, but for the entire period of the second term of the Uribe government. Second is there needs to be more pressure placed on the government to respond to the orders of the Constitutional Court as it relates to the paramilitary, the implementation of the Justice and Peace Law, and to provide more resources to the Attorney General. I'm hoping that the Congress this year will in fact do that. That is, the U.S. Congress will direct a substantial amount of the aid to Colombia directly to the Fiscal General and the Supreme Court. And finally, in dealing with the problems of the Economist article, in dealing with the problems of Colombia, one of the underlying reasons why the FARC has been able to continue, even though it's carried out horrendous violations and linked to drugs in many ways, is because for decades, and even now, rural Colombia has been abandoned. There has not been a significant national effort to deal with rural poverty, and even when the FARC has moved out of an area, there is no significant integrated development program designed to respond to the needs of the people there. That would be extremely important. It would also have some linkage to doing something about coca cultivation, which we can talk about later. But without that, it seems to me that the government and the country is a greater disadvantage in trying to deal with the conflict and with the human rights abuse that follow. And finally, a peace strategy in Colombia requires a willingness to address the structural causes of the conflict, to engage in serious negotiations, to guarantee safe and inclusive participation for all political forces in Colombia's future, and to end impunity. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mark, for a fascinating insight on the Colombian situation, and thank you very much for focusing on my bias suggestion about Colombia. But I do believe that in this hemisphere, when we refer to crisis situations and human rights in that context, Colombia is definitely a very sad example. Our next panelist is Rokus Pronk. He is an alumni of the masters, the LLM, here at the WCL. Rokus served until February 2007 as political advisor to the International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan. And he has served as legal coordinator here at WCL of the War Crimes Research Office in the Center for Human Rights and Humanitarian Law. Rokus is a Dutch diplomat. He has served in several regions of the world, including China. He has been in Brussels, in Ramallah, Sarajevo, among many other places. So I believe that Rokus will give us a very interesting insight of those regions on some of the questions that we are trying to grab. Rokus?
You, of course.
Thank you, Diego. Just brief disclaimer, I'm talking here on my personal capacity and not on behalf of the Dutch government. But very happy to be back in Washington at the Washington College of Law. 13 years ago, I enrolled here in the LLM program, and it was a very exciting time in those days. Bosnia was in flames. We just had the genocide in Rwanda, post-Cold War period, a lot of excitement amongst international lawyers about individual accountability and the tribunals. And we all believed in that in those days, as we still do, but I think it was a different period, obviously. in that environment, I was given the opportunity in 95 after I graduated to help set up the War Crimes Research Office, and I'm very happy that it still exists today. It's really a great honor for me to be back here. I remember studying and working here, and those years have shaped my life ever since then. It's great to be among friends again. I feel very much at home. It also saddens me very deeply that one of my best friends, Brian Tittlemore, is no longer among us. And we lost touch after 1997 when I left. And I remember Brian, I know that Brian was very active for the law school in those years and afterwards. And we all miss him very much. And I'm sure that if he was alive today, he would be sitting here with us on the panel. Diego asked me to talk about my experiences in Afghanistan, in the Middle East, and in Bosnia, where I've served over the last 5 years. And I will try to take you, without taking too much time, through those different crisis situations or post-conflict situations. The experience in all three areas, and in some places, especially Afghanistan, I've served a bit longer, have reminded me and convinced me again that upholding human rights and that the laws of war is not a luxury that we can that can be ignored. On the contrary, they are essential to achieving lasting peace and security. Unfortunately, the political willingness among all actors involved in most of the current conflicts to fully respect and uphold universal human rights standards is something that we cannot take for granted, and for which international lawyers will still have to continue to fight for and argue for. First of all, Bosnia. I worked there in 2005 as political advisor to the Office of the High Representative, the international executive institution that was set up to help implement the civilian aspects of the Dayton Peace Agreement. The visible and physical scars of the war that raged there are slowly disappearing, and Sarajevo is becoming a modern European city, slowly on track towards the European Union. The Bosnian Serbs, the Muslims, and the Croats are living in peace together, although sometimes still very uneasily. The international community took a very hands-on approach, very intrusive, in rebuilding and stabilizing Bosnia. Through the executive powers of the OHR, the Office of the High Representative, domestic laws, including human rights laws, were enacted, and high-ranking Bosnian officials were removed from office when they were obstructing or working in contravention of the Dayton Peace Agreements. Never before, and I doubt ever again, has a country in a post-conflict situation been subject to such an extensive and intrusive international governance. And the Bosnian model is sometimes described as a model that we should apply elsewhere as a success. A lot of effort in Bosnia was put into justice and reconciliation and human rights, and most notably, of course, the International Tribunal, set up in 1993 as a deterrent mechanism to prevent crimes during the conflict, and also as a tool for reconciliation afterwards. The chief prosecutor recently said that the tribunal was extremely successful in bringing people to justice. There are still six, some very important individuals still at large, but it has succeeded in putting to trial 160 people, including presidents, premiers, and military commanders. We still have at large the most important people, I would say, Radovan Karadzic and Ratko Mladic. But the tribunal is now scheduled to finish its trials by 2008 and all appeals by 2010. However, was it a success? And I would say maybe not. The establishment did not prevent the atrocities during the conflict. On the contrary, the biggest slaughter took place after the tribunal was established, Srebrenica. So maybe we should not put too much faith in the notion that international criminal courts can prevent and act as a deterrent in future conflicts. I would say that that notion was maybe naive. The crimes of Darfur show that once again. And perhaps the tribunal was successful in the process of reconciliation and building a lasting peace. A difficult question, we don't know, because the tribunal is there. We don't know what would have happened if it hadn't been there. But what came clear to me when I was in Bosnia, in Sarajevo, that the courts of The Hague were very far away. The recently set up Bosnian local war crimes chamber receives a lot more attention from the media and from the population. The ICTY, in my view, operated for too long, from too great of a distance, And I think if justice is administrated and have an effect on national reconciliation processes, it must have local ownership. Foreign or international courts can only marginally contribute to national peace building and reconciliation. In addition, the ICTY's inability to apprehend the faces and the leaders of that war has weakened the tribunal's credibility. And today it appears not unlikely that those Mladic and Karadžić will escape justice because the international community has not been unified in trying to apprehend these people. And the peacekeeping forces have all shied away from trying to apprehend them even when they knew where they were. So if the tribunal closes in a few years without these men in the dock, it would seem to me to send a very dangerous message and be a real tragedy. So the ICTY has not failed, but the high hopes and expectations that many of us had have not been attained. It left behind a great deal of jurisprudence, but all very valuable, but has not played a significant role in bringing people together. Bosnia is still not a unified state and has still a long way to go if it wants to join the European Union. And for the international community, I think the lessons of the ICTY is that we should have realistic expectations from what an international criminal court can achieve. It will probably not be a deterrent in Sudan, Congo, or Uganda. Such process cannot be led by outsiders, and it has to be, in my view, as soon as possible, as soon as viable, be done locally, and maybe not through courts, but maybe truth commissions or other mechanisms to address transitional justice are a more viable or a better option to contribute to reconciliation processes. Briefly, Palestinian occupied territories. I served there only very briefly, but Diego asked me to say a couple of things about that. I'm not an expert on this conflict, but I worked there as a development and humanitarian officer for about a little less than a year. And I remember participating every Friday in this, what I remember, very frustrating EU-led humanitarian aid coordination meetings. And we tried in those meetings to discuss humanitarian access to Gaza in particular. It was in those days there were a lot of incidents of Qassam rockets flown into Israel and reactions from the Israeli side. And what we were trying to do was ensure that there was humanitarian access for UN agencies to deliver basic humanitarian aid, but also to protect development projects that the international community was implementing in Gaza. But we discussed around in circles, and we were not able to convince either party of the conflict to stop indiscriminate attacks and the use of force and violence and to abide to international humanitarian law and the laws of war. A lot has been written about the applicability of the international laws of war in this conflict, and I will not delve into that except to refer to ICJ opinions and also the Israeli Supreme Court that the Geneva Convention does apply in this conflict. To me, it seemed very clear that the conflict will continue if we do not start applying international human rights and law and international laws of war. It is clearly counterproductive for both sides to constantly resort to indiscriminate violence and a total disregard of the international laws of war. And both parties to the conflict are responsible for that, but I think also the international community, in particular perhaps also the developed Western world, has a responsibility for allowing the situation to continue. UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in the occupied Palestinian territories, John Duard, a well-known South African law professor, stated in 2007 that the occupied Palestinian territories is the only instance in a developing country that is denied the right of self-determination and oppressed by a Western-affiliated state. The apparent failure of Western states to take steps to bring such a situation to an end places the future of the international protection of human rights in jeopardy as developing nations begin to question the commitment of Western states to human rights. Duggart, I think, touches on something very fundamental here, and I believe he's choosing his words very diplomatically and carefully. I'm afraid that many countries are non-Western countries are not beginning to question the commitment of Western states. I fear that they're doing that already for quite some time. If we're not extremely careful and how Western states deal with human rights issues in Afghanistan, Iraq, and the Middle East, then our commitment will simply just not be taken seriously anymore. So allow me here to focus on Afghanistan. I served there for 2 years, in 2002 to 2004 at the embassy, Dutch embassy, and then recently for 6-7 months in southern Afghanistan as political advisor to the Dutch troops in a province called Uruzgan. Afghanistan has been suffered continuous conflict since 1979. Fall of the Taliban after 9/11 led to deployment of peacekeepers in Kabul, 6,000 peacekeepers, and a major effort to try to help reconstruct the country. At the same time, the peacekeepers were in Kabul. There was also an operation in the south, Operation Enduring Freedom. The stabilization and reconstruction of Afghanistan was initially approached what we call the light footprint. The donor community talks about maximum ownership, and ISAF presence was, as I said, limited to Kabul. At the Bonn conference, where an agreement was signed on how to stabilize and reconstruct Afghanistan, it was decided to leave transitional justice off the agenda. The special representative of the UN, Mr. Brahimi, argued that it was too controversial to start dealing with crimes and human rights violations that were committed since 1979. Instead, the agreement focused on a roadmap and timetable for establishing peace and security and reconstructing the country and establishing key institutions, but it ignored the issue of accountability and impunity. So much was achieved during the first few years. Refugees, millions of refugees returned home, schools reopened, and girls went back to school. Elections were held. In 2005, the targets set out in the Bonn agenda were declared to have been achieved. There was a democratically elected president, a parliament, and other institutions. Unfortunately, the situation in Afghanistan did not allow for a scaled-down level of international involvement. The security situation had deteriorated rapidly, and as a result, humanitarian and reconstruction efforts becoming more and more difficult. NGOs were beginning to scale down their presence and sometimes even left. The Taliban, which had been excluded from the political process, was stepping up its insurgency, and in 2006, a wave of attacks of improvised explosives and suicide bombers were seen all over the country, with a particular intensity in the south. Events had developed to such a point that the president, Karzai, took the extraordinary measure of publicly condemning the methods of Western powers who worked to place him in power. In June 2006, he said, "For 2 years, I have systematically and consistently and on a daily basis warned the international community what was developing in Afghanistan and of the need for a change of approach in this regard. The international community must reassess the manner in which this war against terror is conducted." Was Karzai fair when he blamed the international community for the deterioration of security? I'm afraid that we have to admit that he was, even though he himself also has blame to carry for not having been able to establish good governance standards and taking effective and decisive lead in Afghanistan's reconstruction. But let's focus on the mistakes of the international community, or better, the West. What went wrong and why are we losing the moral high ground? Personally, I believe that too many mistakes were made since the fall of the Taliban, and we did not read the signals or listen when we were being warned. We thought we could reconstruct Afghanistan on the cheap and without too much effort. Iraq detracted the attention away from Afghanistan, but even without Iraq, we seem to believe that Afghanistan, after almost 30 years of conflict, could be stabilized and rebuilt overnight without too much investment. We allowed President Karzai to become labeled mayor of Kabul and accepted that the central government's authority was being undermined by war and drug lords all over the country. Already in 2003, when I visited the north, Mazar-i-Sharif, local people were telling me that their lives were less secure and that they were ruled by thugs and that they missed the rule of law of the Taliban. At the national level, we were not able to effectively reform the security sector and help build a national police force and a judicial sector. Especially the latter sector, was hardly touched by donors, and Afghans outside Kabul are still subject to an archaic judicial system, operating light years away from standards set out in human rights treaties. Had we given this reform more priority and given more coherent assistance, we would have responded more adequately to the legitimate demands and expectations of the average Afghan in post-Taliban era. Instead, they just saw a weakened Afghan government and weakened institutions that were not able to protect them from drug and warlords. The lack of progress did not help the way in which people began to perceive the West's commitment to human rights. In southern Afghanistan, the situation was even worse, even sooner. The U.S.-led Operation Enduring Freedom adopted a very kinetic, very military approach to destabilization and reacted very fiercely against insurgent attacks, often resulting in collateral damage that was not understood and thus not accepted by the population. Between my first tour in Afghanistan and the second tour, the South became a no-go area for NGOs, UN, and diplomats, as the operation was stepping up its military activities. Aid workers did not dare to go out of their compounds and were stuck in the cities of Kandahar and others. During my recent tour, many tribal leaders complained that the West always seemed to be working on the basis of wrong intelligence and warned not to repeat the same mistakes. They encouraged you to listen and to delve into the tribal issues. Often at tribal meetings, we were told that they didn't want our bridges, our roads, our clinics, or schools. They just wanted to be treated with respect. The message was loud and clear. We had lost the moral high ground. Often I also asked myself if Brahimi had been right when he decided to leave transitional justice off the agenda. Of course, holding people accountable for past crimes is very politically sensitive and difficult. But we must also realize that each post-conflict situation requires its own solutions and approaches. But instead, to ignore the subject and accept that known warlords who have documented blood on their hands and become governor or serve in a national cabinet is probably a big mistake and sends a very wrong message to victims and perpetrators alike. Currently, the topic is again high on the agenda in Afghanistan, fortunately, I would say, because the Afghan parliament has recently passed a bill in which it declares almost a blanket amnesty for all crimes committed in the past. Another area where we failed drastically is how we deal with counter-narcotics, poppy. We push the government to crack down on poppy cultivation, but we do not deliver in providing farmers with an alternative livelihood. The burning and destruction of poppy fields leads to further unrest and insecurity and pushes farmers in the hands of the Taliban. We have to ask ourselves, I think, the hard question, such as where do human rights fit into this counter-narcotics policy? Is it consistent with human rights norms to take away a family's livelihood when there are no alternatives? Of course, we must find poppy production and narco-mafia practices, but in an environment where poppy is the only alternative because of the climate, because of the soil, we have to invest in long-term alternatives. It's not too late for Afghanistan. We can still succeed in stabilizing it, but we have to accept the mistakes of the past. Way too much effort, I think, has been put into identifying high-value targets and a military approach where we'll have to look at a more balanced mix of diplomacy, development, and defense. If we do not adapt our ways of working and show more respect for human rights in Afghanistan, then we will certainly fail to win back the hearts and minds of the population. I'm hopeful that ISAF expansion and the increasing presence of, albeit Western, but non-US forces in Afghanistan will help steer away the country and will help steer the country back on track. My apologies, Diego, for this very quick and incomplete tour around the world, but just some very brief statements for discussion, perhaps. I think we have still failed to develop the best model for post-conflict reconstruction. Bosnia's heavy and intrusive model or Afghanistan's initial light footprint are both imperfect. There's no scientific model available. In each case, we have to accept that we're dealing with people. So in a post-conflict reconstruction period, we must put transitional justice high on the agenda immediately, but we also must have realistic expectations of it. And as soon as possible, transitional justice mechanisms should be locally led. Only then will it have an impact on reconciliation and peace processes. Justice spoken by distant courts will not have an impact and can potentially harm domestic political processes. In crisis situations, human rights are often seen as soft sector business, whereas if we address them much more seriously and much more dedicated, we will find, I think, that you hold the key to solving many of the conflicts that are still going on. And the last comment, I think, in the post-9/11 world, the international human rights community has so far failed to convince political leaders and decision makers that it's all about pragmatism and that a war against terror can only be won with a renewed, strong respect for human rights. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rogus. We turn now for our third panelist, Nieves Molina, coming from Copenhagen, Denmark. Nieves is a senior legal advisor for the International Rehabilitation Council for Torture and Associate Professor of the Department of International Law in the University of Copenhagen. She was UN Political Advisor at the Disarmament, Reintegration and Repatriation Division and a legal advisor of the UN mission in Congo and the international and legal advisor in the International Criminal Tribunal in Rwanda. She also held positions as legal advisor at the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe in the Balkan region.
Thank you very much. I'm very honored to be here, and even more honored to be in this company. My presentation was already a little bit a tour, as Mr. Prong has put it. But now, after listening to them, they are so inspiring that let's see if we can compile. Diego has entrusted me to talk about human rights in crisis situations, but he incited me to talk about Darfur. And to talk about the African region. Therefore, in this scenario, this crisis situation is going to be a conflict. I have chosen to do an analysis of the human rights situation in conflict. And talking about Darfur or talking about the DRC, I don't think I can bring to you any novelties. I think people knows. I think it's not awareness what we are lacking. We have information, extra information, evidence. There is nothing really new or nothing that we are not aware of. Furthermore, I also think that novelties is not what we are missing, new ideas. Is not what we are missing. What is lacking is the implementation of the human rights legislation and the humanitarian law legislation in the way it has been conceived for years, starting with Nuremberg, Tokyo, the ad hoc tribunals, and the international jurisprudence of which you all are aware of. In that sense, I can warn you, and I can ask for your indulgence, because I cannot be that person that is going to bring a new idea to this university. It's not going to be this presentation. It's not going to be me. If we talk about the situation in Darfur, of which you all know, we are talking about 2 million people being displaced. We are talking about at least 12 aid workers being killed, 5 disappeared. I can, as a personal note, I can tell you that a personal friend of mine was accused of spying and held in custody for a couple of nights in Khartoum before she was deported. The charges were never dropped. Obviously, this is a quite uncomfortable situation. One of my colleagues at the organization was deported upon arrival. A couple of years ago, when we tried to attend to a perfect to a human rights meeting there, even after signing the Darfur Peace Agreement in 2006, or because the signing of the 2000 of the peace agreements in 2006, the government has still found. And excuses to continue with air raids and with what it has been called ethnic cleansing killings, and it has expelled Mr. Jan Pronk, the special envoy, the UN special envoy. It has violated every single article of the SOFA of the agreement between the peacekeeping operation. Or the mission, no, it's not the mission in Sudan, and so it appears that in spite of the ICC deferral, the international pressure, the old trick of Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and basically all of us of name and shame is not working in Sudan. It has been reported that a senior officer of Sudan was asked, and apparently his answer was that they have evaluated the risk between compliance with international community obligations and lack of compliance, and they have rationally chosen not to because it was less costly. Because it was indicated that compliance would mean, in a way, certain institutional changes, even governmental changes, that would come from inside. So this is the scenario as it stands now. Because I have this bias with the DRC, with the Congo, and they share a strange competition. The two countries share, I have read about the two countries that is the worst humanitarian disaster ever, about both of them. Well, it is difficult to understand the Congo without understanding the rest of the Great Lakes. I would not start with a background with Lubumba. I will not start with Lubumba being betrayed and by Mobutu himself, and Mobutu being overthrown by Kabila's father. Kabila's father is supported by Rwanda. We have to remember that he reached power in the aftermath of the genocide, and he's there as a puppet of Uganda and Rwanda, a puppet that turns to want to have his own ideas at some point, which is not well received in Kigali and in Kampala. These are administrations that don't take very well a no for an answer when it comes to natural resources, especially. The DRC is an interesting case to analyze in terms of who is accepted at a negotiation table. After Kabila's father is killed, there is in 2002 there is the Sun City agreements that end up with a very strange government composition, which is a transitional government with one president, which is Joseph Kabila, which is the son, the adoptive son, educated in Tanzania. So it's a kind of neutral figure. It doesn't have a color. Tribal color, in a way. He speaks English, doesn't speak French, and he speaks very badly any other Congolese language, which he pays dearly for that, in his reminded. And four vice presidents that represent the factions, the main factions that have been terrorizing the country. There is one person that arrives late and is not accepted, Lauren Nkunda, who is still a terrorizing in Bukavu. Is a general, a so-called general backed by Rwanda, and he's still committing crimes. Now, in 2006, there is elections, Kabila get elected. Couple of months ago, one of the vice presidents, Bemba, of course, disagrees with the elections, and there is riots again. A week ago, Kinshasa was again evacuated because Bemba was still making troubles. That much for the transitional justice of which Jan Prong was talking about, who is accepted to the negotiation table. In the kind of the kind of conflict that we assist in these two countries is different. I mean, in one of them you have an internal conflict. In the other one, you have an internal conflict plus a conflict that involved at that time five of the major nations in Africa, because the Sun City agreements involve that Angola, Zimbabwe, South Africa, Tanzania, Burundi, Rwanda and Uganda have to withdraw, and Angola, have to withdraw from the country. That meant that we have to establish two systems. We have to establish what it was called the DDRRR, disarmament, demobilization, repatriation, reintegration, and refugees, for dealing with the foreign combatants, and a program of disarmament for nationals that would then be part of a unified national army. That didn't happen that well, as you can imagine. Sudan, the president of Sudan has not denied any of the actions that he's been accused of, not killings, disappearances, rapes. He has never denied that. What he has done is justified it under the laws of emergency, under the laws of conflict. And that is something that we see very often, and we can even capture in The Economist quote that Diego was mentioning. It's very violent to develop human rights policies. Well, humanitarian law is not derogable because it's designed for that. It's designed for conflict. It's a special law that is designed to protect civilians and to protect those that cannot fight any longer. And the jurisprudence of the Yugoslavian tribunals have made sure that by customary law, if you see Tadic, from the ICTY, this is applicable to internal conflicts. And when it comes to human rights law, under a state of emergency, there are certain human rights that can be suspended, but never those that belong to the Article 3 of the Covenant. In other words, not those that involve arbitrary detention or involve summary executions, or especially not torture. That has the prohibition against torture has a level of use governance. And that's the part that I wanted to highlight is the implementation of the law that we are sort of witnessing excuses not to implement the law on the basis of the state of emergency. The tribunal, one of the things that we have been listening the most about Darfur is whether or not it's genocide. And in reality, we know there is evidence of war crimes, those that happen only in times of war. We know that there is clearly crimes against humanity going on, meaning as defined it first in Nuremberg, then in the draft code of by the Law Commission, or in the status of the ad hoc courts, like. Those crimes, above the war crimes, it is the crimes against humanity, those crimes that are applicable in times of war, in times of peace, that happen in a systematic manner or in large scale, and that define prohibited actions, killing, deportation. Genocide is a crime that is didn't exist in Nuremberg and it's a crime that it has a difficulty in to be proved because it has double intentionality. It has the prohibited behaviors plus the double mens rea. One is that you have the intention of killing, deporting, and the other one is that the intention is to exterminate a group of a group of the those that are protected, in part or in whole. The problem is, and in the tribunal in Rwanda had to face that concept again in Akayesu, in the case against the mayor of Taba. And in that case, they came up with a concept that said, well, what is this protective group? Protective group will be those that is permanent, is systematic, is consistent, and is something that you become by birth. So it's and why is because once more the court has to face the situation where it has to define an ethnic group when they look alike, they have the same religion, they speak the same language. However, during the judgment note that every single witness that comes to testify in Akayesu identifies himself with a particular ethnic group. So it takes it into consideration from that point of view. There is difficulties to prove this ethnicity, and there is difficulties to prove the intentionality of destroying a particular group in Darfur, or at least that's how Antonio Cassese, who was the chairman of the investigation of the inquiry commission, decide. That created quite a lot of outrage among the international community or in the NGOs, and I have probably there is a feeling that genocide is a more serious crime than crimes against humanity, and that probably was. It is clear that genocide carries a special stigma. However, there is other crimes against humanity that also carry this bad stigma. Unfortunately, there was three judgments from the ICTY and the ICTR. This was Kambanda, Sarusago, and Krisnich, where the chamber had the idea of calling genocide the crimes of crimes and the most heinous crime. However, there was that was rejected and corrected by the appeal chamber in two cases, in Kajishema and in Rujindana. There is not that hierarchy, or the court, the jurisprudence cannot prove that there is that hierarchy. At this point, I think the international community cannot see an excuse for intervening on whether or not what is going on in Darfur is a genocide or not. Under the right to protect mention, they have enough to intervene if they wish to do so. In different ways, they can do it in using the force under Article 51 of the Charter. They can decide to have a peace enforcement mission. They can establish sanctions, which is important. Or they can use the deference to the ICC, which they have done. Now, one of the questions that comes for me, the most important one, is the targeted sanctions. How, in Congo, and in Congo, and also in Darfur, what we are seeing is that not the militia, not the army, they have never had problems to arm themselves. In fact, there was an inquiry commission from the parliament, from the UK parliamentary, where described the flow of arms in East Congo in the middle of the embargo and in the middle of the fragile peace process. One of the things that I would like to mention now that I have 3 minutes left is that whether or not a tribunal has the mission of reconciliation in terms of the transitional justice. And that brings us directly to philosophy of law. I think justice is not a tool of reconciliation per se. That's one thing. it doesn't mean that the law has not to be implemented, and that the cost of lack of implementation and the cost of the cost of impunity is not a very dearly one that a society pays in the long run. It doesn't need to happen the next day when the ceasefire is still fragile, but crimes against humanity do not prescribe. That's the other thing I would like to say is like how we all feel kind of disappointed about whether or not the tribunals managed to produce an effect of deterrence. The tribunals created a lot of expectations, but the success of the tribunals call for collaboration and call for investment. And we have seen that we have not got neither of them. In the last minute, I just would like to say, in the note of saying that the crimes don't prescribe, I would like to underline that the courts have been very generous or have relied very much on eyewitnesses. In my organization, we have a program, we have a project that what we are intending to do is to involve forensic doctors to document and to investigate cases of torture. That can be used also in patterns, to describe patterns of torture, patterns of mistreatment that can be used in an evidentiary manner in a court procedure. Having that is a mechanism that is called the Istanbul Protocol, if anybody is interested. And I think I have already abused your patience and the patience of the chairman. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Nieves. So let's open the floor for a brief session of questions that you can address to any of the panelists or the panel as such. So if you are interested in making a question to the panel, you can just stand to one of the microphones in both aisles.
Okay. My name is Ali Alchimi. I'm president of Criminal Court of Appeal and I'm a human rights advisor to the Minister of Justice in Egypt. my question about Darfur, it's a legal question. Maybe you are the most qualified to answer it, Diego. How far the international community can interfere to protect the human rights inside an independent state? Is the human right still an interior affair or has become an international affair? And according to the Roma Treaty, which established the ICC, the ICC doesn't have jurisdiction upon states which are not member in this treaty or without the consent of this state. So is it legal that we can, or the Security Council can bring people from Sudan to be tried before the ICC without the consent of Sudan, and the Sudan is not a member of this of Roma Treaty? Is it legal to do that or not? What people say are complaining from the double standard. But the states, the U.S., withdrawn its signature from Roma Treaty. So, I mean, we cannot try. I mean, the ICC has no jurisdiction upon the state, the U.S. So people say that if this happened in a specific state, the ICC can come to try people in this place, even if they are not member in this in the treaty of and they are not member in this tribunal, and in some areas that this ICC cannot come. So is it legal for ICC to come and try people in Darfur or not? And taking into consideration that we cannot compare the ICC with ad hoc tribunals in Rwanda or in ex-Yugoslavia. These tribunals belong to was created by a decision of the Security Council, not with a treaty. So it's confusing a little. Huh. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other question? We can proceed.
Well, first one clarification. The ICC don't come. The ICC is under a very, very strict rule of, which is the principle of complementarity, which we didn't have, which was different, which what we have in the ad hoc tribunals, which the opposite, right? So basically, the ICC does only intervene if the state is not able or is not willing to try. Is it legal? Well, of course, when the hearings open, the first question that the ICC is going to have to solve is the question of legitimacy of its own jurisdiction. That happened to all the tribunals. It's happened in Sierra Leone, it happens in Rwanda, and it happens in Yugoslavia. We have to expect that it happens here too. We'll see what the court says. I would say that it's the Security Council has deferred. Therefore, I would say that it's legal, but because it's under the violations of the state is violating their own obligations. I apparently, and I think you are in better position than I am to answer this question, human rights have become an issue of the international community, and especially in those circumstances that provoke such a crisis that is a threat to peace.
I think that the last really does, to some degree, answer the question as to on what basis. The Security Council, in fact, in the prelude to the resolution in which they found that in which they authorized the International Criminal Court to pursue action in Darfur and Sudan, they in fact cited the responsibility to protect provisions. And let me just note here that, again, it all relates back to in accordance with Chapter 6 and Chapter 7 of the Charter. And it said the international community through the United Nations has a responsibility when, as I said earlier, when the state fails to use appropriate diplomatic, humanitarian, and other peaceful means in accordance with Chapter 6 and 7 to protect populations from genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity, which in fact they found in order to adopt the resolution authorizing the ICC to take action, because they found it to be a threat to international peace and security. And in fact, when you have more than 1 million refugees going across the border and as a result of actions that were to some degree authorized by the government of Sudan, in terms of supporting the militias both in Darfur and going across the border in Chad, there's a fairly strong case that can be made.
Okay, if anyone else has a question, you can approach the microphone again. Say your name and the other microphone is.
Thanks again for the remarks of all the speakers. I have to apologize for coming in a bit late, and I may have missed some of the initial comments by Mark Schneider. But I did have a question with regard to Colombia, and it's your assessment of the complementarity question. It's something that obviously has been considered and debated, but I wondered what your opinion is with respect to the justice and peace law and how that squares with this standard of inability or unwillingness to prosecute crimes within the jurisdiction of the court. And then the other question had to do with the genocide issue that was raised and whether the recent opinion of the International Court of Justice on Serbia responsible for failing to prevent genocide, how it fits into your analysis at all in terms of whether it contributes to that discussion of whether there's a hierarchy and whether there's more of a reason to intervene, perhaps in one case, genocide versus crimes against humanity or war crimes. Love your remarks, and again, thank you to all of the panelists.
Thank you, Susana. Perhaps we can receive the second question and then answer both.
I have one comment.
If you can state your name.
My name is Ayman Youssef. I'm a legal advisor for Norconsult Telematics. I'm here on my personal in my personal capacity. Regarding the situation in Darfur, as you know, by the day it's getting like worse, and there is like clear evidence that the government is like a party to some of these violations, as well as the rebel groups. If you look at the government of Sudan, like during the past like 2 years, have been like manipulating really the even the Security Council. And one of the things that were expected from the Security Council, like sanctions against the Sudanese government, which was very much like blocked by the the Chinese government, which has like great like interest in oil in Sudan. I wonder if there is like any course of action, because like what I notice is like people are talking about like trying to accused or suspects of violations of human rights. Actually, it's way more than two persons, and apparently the focus should be on stopping like those mass violations instead of trying two or four people. Wonder if there is any course of action being contemplated by any party. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So we can begin.
Marty, I'll start.
Yeah.
Well, first, with respect to the Justice and Peace Law, the original that was proposed by President Uribe was totally inadequate. There was no representation. There was no place for the victims to be represented. And there was virtually no penalty that was going to be imposed upon those members, in this case the paramilitary or other illegal armed groups, who came to say we're giving up our weapons and therefore we'd like to be absolved of all criminal actions that we've committed. And there were subsequent a series of amendments. The JPL became slightly better. However, even today, the Constitutional Court in Colombia has still demanded further action by the government in terms of implementing regulations in order to provide more adequate consideration of the displaced, because the government did not have any provision for the displaced and other victims to, in a sense, make their case when these individuals were coming up to seek essentially the reduction of sentences, assuming that they met all of the qualifications, i.e., full disclosure of their crimes, giving up all assets, providing full information as to the word victims, presumably graves, or and their linkages to the other parts of the Colombian security structure. If they did all of that and dismantled the organization, then they would be, under the JPL, able to have their sentences reduced to as little as 8 years. There's still, I think, grounds for victims to carry that beyond the Colombia context and to demand further action, perhaps, and challenge within the Inter-American system the adequacy of the law. The one thing is that as I said again, the Fiscal General, the Attorney General, has undertaken investigations to demand, at the very least, that those who are seeking the reduction of penalties meet those conditions, provide full evidence, and that hasn't happened. And one of the other demands being made on the government of President Uribe is that he has asserted, the government executive branch has asserted, these 2,300 individuals who are going to seek reduction in sentences, that they're eligible for the JPL, which means that the executive branch, in a sense, is saying they have committed crimes for which the JPL is appropriate. However, it didn't provide any information to the Attorney General as to what crimes the government knew they committed. Sort of name, serial number, that's it. So there's still much to be done there. With respect to Darfur, there are a whole range of other actions that we've pressed for that hopefully we'll see in terms of sanctions against a range of individuals and companies linked to the government in an effort to force the government to abide by its agreement to permit a peacekeeping force, now it's called a hybrid force, to enter Darfur and protect the camps and protect civilians, which they've refused to do. And we've been urging that that those sanctions be imposed against all individuals linked to the ethnic cleansing and the violations, and that basically sanctions be imposed against anyone operating in the oil industry in Sudan, which is what finances the military and the government party.
I'm gonna stop there.
Any comments from the panel?
Maybe on the hierarchy issue, whether in the case of violation of human rights, it seems to me that what the responsibility to protect does is saying there is a hierarchy, and that at a point at which those violations reach the level of genocide, ethnic cleansing, massive atrocities, at that point a state may not fold itself within the cover of national sovereignty to deny the international community the ability to intervene. And at that point is where the international community, not necessarily, remember, this is not militarily only, it's through the international community using all of the instruments available, ideally through the Security Council authority, in terms of diplomatic, economic, political, and other measures, attempts to prevent further genocide and atrocities from being committed, and attempts to take collective action to protect the victims.
You want the follow-up question and whatever you want.
No, but I was about to answer to your question, so you can. My analysis is a legal analysis on whether or not crimes are more valuable than others. Genocide is a terminology like ethnic cleansing. Ethnic cleansing is not a legal terminology yet. It's a diplomatic term that is used politically in terms of whether or not it's more serious or less serious, of compiles more to intervene. Are we serious? Are we saying here that if a community of women are systematically raped because they are all from the same ethnic background, is that more serious criminally? It deserves a higher punishment, a heavier intervention that it is not. I mean, how do we evaluate that? The question is that genocide has a political connotation that involves terrible consequences, and the place to see it and to feel it is the Great Lakes. I mean, if you remember, there was a massacre in Gatumbe. This is Burundi. There is a camp, and there is 100 people killed, and that camp contains people from two ethnic regions. What it would be equivalent to Hutu and Tutsis, but Banyamulenge. These people get killed in terrible circumstances. Nobody really understood because they arrive singing, there is a police station 2 kilometers away, they don't move, they don't do anything. Nobody can understand why in the camp there was tents in two colors, the Banyamulenge were in the white color, all the Banyamulenge were in one of the tents. This is a very particular issue on the territory of Congo. Immediately, Congo is accused of once more promoting genocide against the Tutsis in Burundi. Immediately, it has nothing to do with him, but immediately Kagame from Rwanda stands up and say that if this is genocide, the troops of Rwanda are ready to protect. Well, in reality, we know how easy the Rwandese troops go into Rwanda. Last time they went into Congo, they invade Congo to protect the Banyamulenge, they were into Congo, 27 in a proportion of territory that is 27 times bigger than Rwanda itself. They started for 5 years, and basically what they were doing is exploiting national resources. Otherwise, how do you explain that Rwanda can export coltan if they don't have coltan in their own territory? These facts have to be checked. My analysis is a legal analysis. It's just if there is a hierarchy of the crimes that deserve more punishment or less than others, when it comes to universal jurisdiction and the obligation of states to prosecute, it affects to genocide and to crimes against humanity, and by the way, to war crimes as well.
I would agree with you probably that I don't think there is a huge hierarchy between certain crimes. Like, so my question was more related to whether there's a practical impact of the ICJ decision on its use politically by states. I mean, it certainly raises a legal responsibility on the part of states. So does it affect the ability to gather support for intervention in some cases more than in others? In any case, I appreciate your comment. I just had one other question that I left off the table, which was for Brokus, which was, you said that justice was left off the agenda in Afghanistan, and I wonder, is there any hope to resuscitate that as part of the agenda, despite the fact that there's a deteriorating conditions of security in the country?
What was left of the agenda was transitional justice, dealing with past crimes. That was deliberate. We started a debate from the Dutch embassy in 2003 already. We organized a conference in The Hague and invited Afghan authorities to talk about this issue and to talk about different models. How do you address the issue? And that resulted in a national transitional justice action plan that was adopted by the government, but that's been left on the table. It's not being implemented at the moment, so it requires a constant pushing from the diplomatic community to implement this action plan. And now we are facing this issue of the sort of amnesty law that has been signed by Parliament, and in order for it to be implemented or ratified, the president needs to sign off on it. And he is under a great deal of pressure from Parliament to sign off on it. We don't know yet whether what he will do with it. We do know that this president does not have a track record of standing up against pressure from the Afghan Parliament and other power brokers, so we have to see. But it's a major concern, because I think it is one of, there are many failures, mistakes that we made in Afghanistan, but I think this is really a key area that we need to continue to push for, because people demand it. I was serving in Uruzgan, a very remote province, where people haven't seen any change since the fall of the Taliban, and I would argue they've seen the situation get worse. But there, even people in small villages are demanding from their leaders, from their government, that they act in a live up to standards of good governance, and they don't want to be governed by people who have blood on their hands. So even there, people who are uneducated, far away from the diplomatic talk in the capital of Kabul, they know that they are being governed by crooks and people that need to be held accountable. So it's an issue. If we want to continue helping assist Afghanistan to stabilize, we need to address it. And, I'm actually glad that Afghan Parliament passed this bill, because it puts it on the agenda again. And so it's an issue. It's the issue at the moment in Afghanistan.
Well, you want a comment?
Yes. Can I just put a last question to the audience. I mean, I'm not sure to have an answer, but we are talking about intervention, and some of this intervention would call for the use of force. And intervention in a country will call for investment and for resources. And one of the things that we have seen in the past, I don't know if you would agree, is that when for one reason or another, the structures collapse, what it happens is that organized crime takes over the nominally the governmental positions. I don't know how to avoid that. I really don't know how to avoid that when a system collapses, for one reason or another, to limit the impact of those of those that are basically somehow organized criminals of one kind or another, some of them with a lot of access to resources of drugs or trafficking in women or whatever, I mean, that we have seen. And that vacuum is really, really very, very difficult to avoid and very, very complicated in terms of the how the civil institutions that we are going to build after the peace agreement, these institutions have to be solid. And then justice and transitional justice and reconciliation. But most of that, I have seen it. I have seen it in many countries.
Let me just follow up on that one point. I think that's a very, it's essential that, and increasingly, I think those who are involved in post-conflict reconstruction and stabilization issues are recognizing that if you don't develop strategies for dealing with spoilers, particularly organized crime, they will act, and you'll be in a position then of having to try and, in the aftermath of their acquiring some degree of legitimacy, as in Afghanistan, where they are within the parliament, some government, some governors rather, some police chiefs, it's much more difficult now than if the international community had been clear earlier about developing a strategy to prevent that. And essentially, I think, in the case of the warlords in Afghanistan, to give a choice between either ending their criminal linkages and moving into a political role, or not moving into a political role. And I think that the international community has to develop a much clearer sense, just as you know we talk now about developing security sector reform, about developing a rule of law, both say civilian police and judiciary, you need to have a clear strategy of how you're going to deal with the spoilers.
Well, I think, first of all, thank you very much for the panel. It was a very interesting presentation, and I think we have focused on several key issues that are going to be the center of attention from now on in many of these very complex situations around the globe. I want to echo what Rokus mentioned during his presentation about Brian Tittemore, our friend and colleague who passed away in this December, and simply just to say that we are going to miss him very much and that we intend to honor his life and his work by continuing to work in this effort and the perseverance to protect and promote human rights around the world. He did a very important work in the Inter-American Commission in academic scholarly writings, and I think that